Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ed O'Chester. Ed O'Chester's new book is Unreconstructed, Poems Selected and New, published by Autumn House Press. He is the author of more than 14 volumes of poetry, including Snow White Horses, Selected Poems, also by Autumn House, a chapbook entitled Republic of Lies by Adastra Press, The Land of Cocaine by Storyline Press, and changing the name to O'Chester. He has published poems in American Poetry Review, Poetry, The Nation, Agni, Barrow Street, Prairie Schooner, and many other magazines. His poem, Voltaire et Serret, is included in Best American Poems 2007. He has been editor of the Pitt Poetry Series since 1978, and has just edited a new anthology of that series entitled American Poetry Now. He is a founding editor of the literary magazine 5AM. O'Chester is former director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Pittsburgh, where he is professor emeritus of English. He is a core faculty member of the Bennington College MFA Writing Seminars. He has received many awards for his work, including most recently the George Garrett Award from the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. He lives in Appalachia in rural western Pennsylvania. Hi, Ed. How are you doing?
Jan, how are you?
Oh, good.
Good to be back.
It is. It's been a while. And we're celebrating your new book, Poems Selected and New, and published by Autumn House. And we want to mention Michael Sims, who does a great job with Autumn House.
Certainly does.
Autumn House is published locally, but it's a national press. It's just housed in Pittsburgh. So thanks to Michael.
Yeah, and really taking off now, too.
Mm-hmm. So what are you going to start with?
I'm going to read some poems from the new book, of course. A couple of older ones in the selected section, and then mainly newer ones out of the last couple of years. I want to start with a poem called The Heart of Owl Country. To the heart of owl country, whatever blossoms is rooted in the dark as item, the delicate purple comfrey flower supported by a brutish taproot that powers itself into the subsoil and splits the shale a dozen feet beneath me, so that the bumblebees tumble in a drunken frenzy here and item. How if I tend my loneliness, which is no rarer than yours, friend, I grow stronger, so that my fists open, and the garden becomes a natural metaphor for what we have always known, that only by going deeply as possible into our dark can we discover ourselves to others. And even though the stutterer I have always been would like to say, we will never die, I know that we will utterly, except for what we yield to friends or progeny. And that's the garden part. And I remember now what I'd forgotten for years, how once, when we were driving to my mother's in New York State, at twilight, passing through a large marsh, my daughter said, look! And in every dead tree, there was an owl, hundreds of them, stupid in the light, like a faculty senate, staring uncomprehendingly at the swamp and the cars on the interstate, so still. One could have knocked them off their perches with a stick, and my daughter screamed, delighted, this must be the heart of owl country. And it was, those soft fists of feathers waiting for their hour, long after we'd passed, lifting into the spring air on their solitary flights, each silent in its large community, alert and perfect. This next one is another poem that deals with the past and family. It's called Dreaming About My Father. I think it's pretty self-contained. It says what it has to say within the poem, but it is important perhaps to emphasize that it's about a man who grew up in poverty and who, when he had a chance, discovered that he liked to make things grow, that he liked to garden. Dreaming about my father. We're painting the old house in the Hudson Valley, and we're a team, applying the paint so smoothly that not a drop gets spilled. It's all cream. And for the first time, he has no complaints about the way I work. Good job, he says, and smiles when we climb down the ladders and take a break for a beer. He tells me again about how he loves this place, how he loves the country, how poor his family was growing up in Brooklyn, how ashamed he was that my grandmother had to take in washing and scrubbed steps to meet the rent on their smelly apartment on Chauncey Street. And for once, I listened to him without yawning. Why don't we pick some stones out of the garden, he says. And we do that. We take the old wheelbarrow, which doubles as a cement trough, and pick a couple of loads of stone from the rocky patch where he grows golden bantam corn, his favorite, and the beans, and the carrots that never form straight roots, and the tomatoes in such abundance that I still have photos of them, my grandmother smiling over the bushels of red fruit in front of her. The first hummingbird I ever saw as a child keeps buzzing between the salvia and the rose of Sharon. I'm sorry, he says, as we roll a load of stones toward the wall he's building near the big maple. I'm sorry that I didn't talk to you more. What can I say? I was tired and angry, and that I called you good for nothing. It's okay, I say. That's so long ago. I want you to know that after you died, I came back. After the airport expanded and I took all the places on this road, I came back twice. By the first time, they'd flattened everything. But I took a few stones that were left from the fireplace you built, and I have them still. That fireplace, he says. I taught myself how to build from stone. I say, last year was the second time. It was so grown over, it was hard to find the place. But I finally did because of the red maples you planted was still there among the wild trees. It's a shame, he says, how they took the place and never even used it after all that work. Yes, but the catalpa trees you planted, they've spread everywhere. It must be a half mile in every direction down to the brook and up the hill near where the Dolans lived. I know, he says. But it doesn't matter. Now that we're here and we're talking, now that we don't even have to talk. Okay, let me change the tone of that little bit. This is a little poem called Pocahontas. Pocahontas, everything in it that's an assertion of fact is true. Pocahontas. Disney didn't tell you. Then when she first slept with Captain Smith, she was 12 years old. And at that time, organized nude dancing by her young friends for the delectation of the colonists. If this disturbs you deeply, you're probably beyond help. You should go to Orlando and stand in line for 3 hours in the rain. Take a snapshot of Goofy. Oh, two other things. In colonial Virginia, the age of sexual consent was 10. And if you eat of the fruit of Disney, you will die.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty.
What am I listening to?
I'm Jan Beatty. My guest tonight is the poet Ed Ochester, reading from his book, Unreconstructed, Poems Selected and New. I was trying not to laugh, and then you started laughing.
Oh, well, you might as well have fun.
That's right. You might as well have fun. That's totally true. Unreconstructed is a terrific book. Includes some poems from Dancing on the Edge of Knives, Miracle Mile, Land of Cocaine, changing the name to Ochester. But it also has a good chunk of new work.
Yeah.
About 20 pages or so.
Well, actually, it's a little bit more than that even, so I feel very pleased with it.
Yeah,
I wanted to, because the previous selected poems had sold out, was out of print. There were difficulties in reproducing it. That's also an Autumn House book. And Mike Sims suggested about a year and a half, 2 years ago, that we might redo the selected with some new poems in it. It seemed to me that was a very good idea because I wanted to have the older poems around too. And at the same time, I had most of a new book ready to go, and I took the poems that I like most from the new book and put those in the new section here. So it's, in one way, it's two books in one. It's a great bargain, even cheaper on Amazon. And I'm pleased with it. It should be around for a while in print, and it does have most of the older poems that I want to keep in print available. So it's a pleasure for me to look at this, tell the truth.
Yeah, it's great. Your work, you know, your work just gets better and better. And recently the poet Gerald Stern talked about you as one of his favorite poets. It seems like some poets, after they have a few books, stray from what they do best, or they want to do like 10 new things, and their work never seems to have that great energy of their first book. But in your work, it seems like you've stayed true to a sense of an aesthetic, a way of writing that's fairly narrative, and that you're showing us how to be true to this sense of craft and to dedicate ourselves to the poem. I mean, am I on the right track here?
Yeah, it's in the ballpark, certainly. I mean, one of the things that I've never had a difficulty with is the notion of using narratives. You know, in fact, there's an explosion that you might call new narrative in American poetry right now, despite the fact that for many years, a narrative has been viewed by some writers as basically old hat or no longer really possible. Well, I'm dealing with something that is not really a theoretical thing, except that I know that people like stories and I know that I like to tell stories. And so there is this narrative base in many of my poems. And as for wanting to do new things, what I've wanted to do my whole life is do what I'm doing, except do it better.
Yeah.
And if that happens, and if people think that, then that's wonderful. But what I want to do is a sharper ability, a stronger ability to tell some stories out of American life that bear not only on my own life and the people I know, but that also speak in some ways to the lives of other people. And a part of those narratives is a sense that I have increasingly that we are getting nuttier and nuttier as a culture, and that nuttiness is often reflected in some of the comic poems that I do and some of the surreal mannerisms that appear in some of the poems, not all of them. But my aim right now is just to keep in the same track, but to go a little bit further and further out in terms of representing what I see around me. And so a happy older poet rather than a bitter older poet. Nor am I looking for other things to do. So, yeah.
And that's great to see. That's really great to see, because we all know some bitter older poets, and
there are some. Yeah. And the aim is to be, a person like Stern as a writer, I think, and there's certainly a lot of them in American literature who have written, as they've gotten older, better and better and more gracefully, and one would like to be in that number.
That's right. Okay. Can you read some more, please?
Yeah, these are a few more from the new poems in the book. I'm proud of this one because this one is the one that got in Best American Poetry this year, Voltaire at Surrey, 1736. Emily, the love of his life, took him to her castle, where they built laboratories and libraries and workrooms for the life of the mind, as well as the bed, and studied Newton and Locke, and recruited neighbors to act in plays and read poetry aloud at 4 a.m., and enjoyed exquisite food and wine. And such were the times that even Emily's husband became fond of Voltaire. And once, catching the great man with another woman, scolded him for being unfaithful to us. Perhaps this is what the phrase "the Enlightenment" means. Though their behavior titillated most of France, which acted like us, reading People and Star, clucking, sanctimonious and jealous, slaves to our sadnesses, envious. Though, of course, we'd draw a blank at the Newton and the Locke and the poetry parts. Poem called Fred Astaire. Fred Astaire. The secret of his popularity was that he looked like a bus driver who could dance. In my teens, I hated his movies and told my Aunt Carrie they were corny and unrealistic. But she just laughed and said, "You go to his movies because they ain't realistic." Aunt Carrie, who worked as a file clerk and spent an hour each way on the subway commuting. And later, if I'd been honest, I would have realized that's why I loved Dickens and Keats, his Grecian urn. And doesn't Fred look a bit like Carlos Williams, who also talks plain without ornament, just like a stare when he's singing? A critic said he had an unspectacular voice and lacked the vocal technique of a trained singer, but had great respect for the lyrics and immaculate timing, so that even Mel Torme called him, as the jazz singer, the greatest, bar none. And how wonderful that the man who danced with Ginger Rogers and Rita Hayworth and Judy Garland, and worked with the Gershwins, Ira and George, and Noel Coward, was really named Frederick Austerlitz, the son of an immigrant. And that when he took his first screen test, some moron, probably an early critic of Williams too, reported to his boss, "Can't act, can't sing, balding, can dance a little." No wonder Carrie loved him as she shuttled underground in New York, where nearly everyone, if they worked their asses off 40 plus a week, got enough to live on and, like most Americans, lived on dreams. Okay, this is your request, Jan, March of the Penguins. This has a little epigraph from the New York Times at the top of it, which is, "The editor of National Review urged young Republicans to see the movie because it promoted monogamy. A widely circulated Christian magazine said it made a strong case for intelligent design. What the hell are they going to do now with the libidinous bluebird who lines up a couple of extra girlfriends every summer? Not to mention the evil house wrens. Don't be fooled by their cheery little calls. They have up to 5 mates at a time. I won't even mention the gay rabbits we had once, in love with one another's ears, etc. And even now, my old friend Walter may be declaiming how God planted dinosaur bones to test the faith of Christians with the appearance of evolution, thereby demonstrating once again we are the first country to pass from barbarism to decadence without an interlude. And as for intelligent design, even Britney Spears wouldn't drop her eggs at 70 below.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Ed Ochester. He's reading from his new book, Unreconstructed, which was just published by Autumn House Press. Thanks for reading that, Ed.
Okay.
Nice poem. I want to talk about the range of your references, which is very far-reaching in this book, in your books. You know, we could, you know, pick any poem and we might run into a reference of Prince Eugene, Napoleon's viceroy in Italy, and then the next page might be Burger King, and then the next page we might find Britney Spears or the Pope. And it's pretty wild. Can you talk about that? It's like equal opportunity references or something.
Well, as you understand, I am a very learned and hip guy.
That's right. That's clearly what's happening.
One of the things that I will say about that is that I've always made a conscious effort in my poems where I'm referencing such things to make it clear in context, you know, what the reference is about. You know, it's not perfect, of course. There may be a few things, but I've always hated that reaction to poetry that you find among teachers at various levels. You don't know what that means? Look it up. Well, my aim as a writer is not to confront the people of my own time with a kind of lesson book and say, look, what I want to have is something that communicates, and something that communicates with pleasure. But at the same time, my own life, and I think all of our lives, should be lives of openness to not only current events of all sorts, but to historical events. We ought to know, you know, where we come from. We ought to know some of the things that, in fact, have resulted in things that matter for us. We ought to know history. I understand a lot of people don't, and a lot of people think that history is very dull. My sense, and it's reflected in a number of the poems in this book, is that there's an enormous wealth of material useful for poems in the books that I read and the historical works that I read. I enjoy doing it. I enjoy taking the odd fact, the peculiar fact, the thing that seems to throw light on a current event and using it in a poem. So it's a kind of natural thing. And beyond that, like most Americans, you know, I go to the movies, I watch television, I do all that stuff. So it's natural that there be those references there, too.
Mm-hmm. A lot of poets would not touch the Britney Spears reference.
Yes. And I think that the poem would work if you cut off the last few lines. A friend of mine who was editing a special issue of a magazine and asked for poems had indicated that. But I like just the little extra essence of coming back to a contemporary event, to coming back to something that seems utterly stupid, even though in a few years no one may know who Britney Spears is. And my sense always with that is, so what? You know, so that may be a poem that has a fast half-life. All poems have half-lives. All poems will disappear in time, with the exception of a very few. So it's not really worth worrying about. But I enjoy being as much involved with cultural references of my own time as I can be.
Okay, we have time for just a couple more poems.
Let me read a poem which is not exactly a comic poem. It does bear on what happened in New Orleans a couple of years ago. And it does bear on something that's very interesting to me, the rush that a number of people had to find reasons for it and things and people to blame. The poem is called Theodicy. In New Orleans, God punished fornicators and fornicatrixes, or George W. Bush, or the tribe of Ham, or the tribe of Benjamin, or Alzheimerites, or the unemployed, or white landlords, or Paul Prudhomme, or cats, dogs, and canaries, or levees, or the secret juju gods of the Louis Armstrong Airport, or brass musical instruments, or Ms. Marcella D. Washington, or Zydeco, or pride, sloth, greed, gluttony, lust, anger, and envy, or Cokie Roberts, or Snowball the Dog, or the Tulane Green Wave, or the Bourbon Street Tabernacle Choir, or Catholics with 8-plus children, or Catholics with no children, or evangelicals in wheelchairs, or pro-life activists, or children and fetuses, or none of the above, or all of the above. Let me do a real short one. This is called Why I Love Teenagers. In Holiday Park, PA, the Burger King has put out a signboard advertising for late-night employees, and some kid contemptuous of minimum wage or the free enterprise system, and possibly even In God We Trust, has stolen the C from the sign so that it reads, Now Hiring Losers.
Thanks, Ed. It was great.
Thank you.
The poetry of Ed Ochester, reading from his book, Unreconstructed, Poems Selected and New by Autumn House Press. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Tonight's sound engineer is Amy Sutton. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.